Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. And yeah, we've got a great show for you this week. We'll be having a chat with Paul Marsh about a recent report from UK think tank Chatham House. The report says there's a looming cybersecurity crisis about to wreak havoc on the satellite ecosystem. But as you'll hear, Paul thinks the concerns are somewhat overhyped. In this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Space Rogue, aka Tenable Network Security's very own Chris Thomas. He's joining us this week to talk about election security, or e-voting security. Two new bills dealing with the security of voting computers have been proposed in the USA, and we'll get Chris's thoughts on how likely those bills are to actually make a difference. We also have a general discussion around the security of e-voting infrastructure, and you know, that's the sort of brief, that's the sort of interview brief that sounds like it should be dull, but that's actually a really interesting interview, mostly because of recent events like the DNC hack. This stuff got very real very quickly. This week's show is, of course, brought to you by Tenable Network Security, the numero uno risky business sponsor for the last 9 years or so. And hey, you know what? If your organization uses Google Cloud, you are in luck, because a few weeks back, Tenable announced integration with Google Cloud. This stuff integrates really well with most cloud infrastructures. So yeah, if you're in the market for some vulnerability scanning or log correlation tech, do check out Tenable at tenable.com. But of course, before we get into all of those interviews, we've got some great news this week to get through. Joining us again this week is Adam Boileau to discuss the week's news. And Adam, Yahoo.
So yeah, Yahoo's having a bad time, which I guess is not news to anyone who's been on the internet for, you know, I don't know, the last 20 years. Mm. Yahoo's having a bad time in the sense that they lost, apparently this time, half a billion users worth of user details and hashed, at least hashed, passwords. Although apparently password reset questions and answers not so hashed, which is kind of worse than passwords because you can't really change your mother's maiden name so easily. But yeah, they had a bad time. Apparently they got popped back in 2014, and then the data has started surfacing on the internet for people to acquire. Yahoo, of course, is saying that, well, you know, nation states did it, so we can't.
Oh, I love that.
I know, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
The Chinese ate my homework.
Yeah, exactly right. Does not take nation state level capability to own Yahoo. I'm pretty sure the success of their bug bounty program illustrates that.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, they pulled the dog at my homework excuse, claimed it was nation state, and what could they plausibly do to protect it, which is just simply not good enough for something on the scale of Yahoo and affecting that many users. But yeah, it's a tough time for Yahoo, not just obviously because they had all their data stolen, but because they're also in the middle of trying to get sold. And yeah, that may well be the real cost for Yahoo shareholders is what this does to the amount of money they can get out of AOL.
And look, the New York Times has written an absolutely awesome piece about this, really looking at, you know, they had a bunch of ex-Yahooers, ex-Yahoo paranoids in there, basically saying that management were refusing to listen to the security group when the security group wanted to make some substantial changes, which, you know, I mean, I can see it from both sides, right? Because both the senior levels of management and the security team essentially inherited 20 years of technical debt by that point. Do you know what I mean? So it's, you can kind of see both sides of it. But yeah, by when you read this New York Times piece, you're certainly left with the impression that the security people weren't taken seriously by top management.
Yeah, I mean, you get the impression that, of course, that Yahoo's, you know, key metric was how many users have they got, and anything that discouraged users interacting with Yahoo services or signing up for Yahoo services or encouraged them to leave was really just never going to happen, because the important thing was that they had to keep not losing users, not hemorrhaging, not losing to Google. And of course, security mechanisms necessarily, you know, make people's experience of using the site and using services, you know, less pleasant, even though they are, you know, kind of better for them overall. It doesn't make them feel good about using it in the immediate term. And so, yeah, instead of investing in kind of the way that Google did in making security a kind of key part of the offering. Well, I guess I'm thinking specifically of Gmail versus Yahoo Mail rather than, say, Android versus anything. I guess at least Yahoo didn't make a phone, because that would have been worse than Android.
The Yahoo phone. The Y! Phone. Can you imagine a Yahoo phone? It would have been like the home screen just would have all been toolbars.
The big Y exclamation mark on the back instead of like the Apple or the you know little Google logo or whatever. It would be so bad. Such an awful. They should have done that. I guess it would have distracted from all the other things they got wrong. But yeah, you really get the impression that the security people, and there's lots of really good security people at Yahoo who clearly didn't get listened to and weren't you know, seen as a thing that would really help them, you know, enhance shareholder value or whatever it is that they're doing over there at Yahoo HQ. But yeah, it's a...
Well, it feels sure like a closing chapter repeating. Given that they've agreed to sell their core assets already. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is just the final little nail in the coffin. And it's, I mean, $500 million, that's something. I remember seeing Troy Hunt talking about this on Twitter, just saying, you know, if I have to email all of their users notifications as part of have I been pwned, I mean, that's going to cost him some serious cash, right?
Even just storing that in his database, like he's going to have to buy more disks and RAM just to keep the indexes in memory.
So guy. There you go. Yahoo owned by a nation state. I mean, look, it's it does feel a little bit dog ate my homework, but it is plausible that a nation state could be behind it. But that's not really the point, is it? The point is anybody could have done it.
Well, I mean, you know, they did demonstrably get owned by a nation state, right? The same nation state that owned Google back in the day and prompted such a lot of changes at Google. And clearly Yahoo did not learn from that experience. And maybe, of course, clearly they are also still getting owned by nation states to this day. But nation states don't steal your database and dump it on the internet, you know?
Yeah.
They got better things to do with it.
Well, I mean, DNC incidents say otherwise, but yes, you know, I do know what you mean. Yes.
You know, modern politics notwithstanding.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, now the other big news over the last couple of weeks, actually, and we did touch on this briefly last week, was Krebs on Security being DDoSed. By, you know, people angry about him doxing some guys who later got arrested. What is interesting, though, is that Akamai dumped Krebs. They'd been offering him pro bono protection, and they pulled the pin on him, which Krebs is very understanding of, and, you know, so am I, really, because they'd helped him fend off a number of attacks. But when someone's sending over, like, 620 gigabits per second of data, like, that's a lot to absorb pro bono.
Well, yeah, and obviously Akamai has a whole bunch of paying customers, you know, and if they can't meet their service levels for their paying customers because Krebs has eaten 600 gigabit of traffic, then yeah, I mean, it's the wise business choice, right, to just ditch it and go, sorry, buddy, you're going to have to go, you know, see Google or Cloudflare or whoever else and get somebody else to pick up your tab.
But I don't know. I mean, you know, Google has, I mean, that's the other thing that's happened. The latest development with this story is that Google, under its Project Shield, is now assisting Krebs to, you know, keep his website online. And I didn't even know about that project previously, but it's designed for this specific purpose, particularly to protect journalists from these types of attacks. So that is pretty cool. But, you know, you sort of wonder who else. I'm guessing Akamai is going to make a bit more of an investment now that they've seen these types of attacks, and they're going to sort of upgrade things so that it wouldn't be a risk to their service level agreements with other customers in the future, because you can bet whoever's got this capability is eventually going to hit one of their clients. So I'm guessing they're going to be rolling out some changes soon. But you sort of wonder who else could actually deal with this. And even if they could, the costs to the end customer are just going to be prohibitive, right? I mean, this is a genuine game changer, this botnet, which it turns out consists of compromised IoT devices.
Well, yeah, I for one am shocked and horrified, right? The Internet of Things would get owned. But yeah, it is certainly kind of a development in that it's not reflected. Like, we haven't seen a DDoS this big, that I'm aware of, that wasn't a kind of amplified, reflected one, like a straight
We
up.
Haven't seen a DDoS this big, full stop, Adam. Well, it's a world record holder. And, you know, we've seen a couple of 1 terabit per second ones post this, you know, obviously coming from the same people. But can you imagine if they tweaked their botnets to actually do reflection? Do you know what I mean? If this is what they can do without reflection, what can they do with reflection? This is a game changer.
Yeah, it's a fair amount of tube, but I mean, I guess, you know, I guess Google's got a lot of tube, so if Google's gonna you know, hoover it up, well, I guess we'll see how they do. But I mean, as a, you know, as a company that is hoovering up botnet DDoS attacks, it's got a good recon to have someone like Krebs, who's always going to be a target of the latest and greatest and biggest, you know, to kind of let you see what your other customers that are more boring and corporate are going to get 6 months down the track. So yeah, I don't know, maybe Google will learn something useful.
Brian Krebs is the highest profile information security journalist on the planet, right? So it's quite easy for him to make a few calls and kind of sort it out. Now, I know I've been in touch with him and he's not been having a good time, right? But at the same time, this isn't a fatal blow to him. What I worry about his other businesses that they're not going to have anyone to help them. Do you know what I mean? And this is a colossal amount of traffic. And it's and what's amazing is they half-assed it and still had this effect. You know, it sort of feels like we just haven't got anywhere with DDoS. Every time it feels like things are kind of under control, something like this happens.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, like Cloudflare soaks up a fairly significant amount of DDoS for a lot of people who are small and who couldn't afford, you know, what previously you would have got from Prolexic or Akamai or someone
at,
you know, big corporate rates. I mean, Cloudflare has, I think, changed the DDoS protection game, you know, for small people who don't have as much influence. You know, it's a very different world for them than it was before Cloudflare. So, I mean, I think there, you know, the game is changing on both sides, obviously.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see what happens, and we'll see if Cloudflare can absorb this crew's attacks, and we'll see what happens to this crew, right? Because, yeah, anyway, that's, I mean, DDoS stories aren't often this interesting, so that's a fun one to chat about. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security in the United States has announced its intent to draft IoT an IoT security framework. I'm guessing the timing here is a coincidence, but also maybe a tad too late, certainly for Brian and Akamai.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously getting on top of Internet of Things rubbish is a, you know, is a thing that we in the, as the industry really do have to you know, to do something about. And it is too late, obviously. I mean, when there's a terabit of ownable IoT devices out there to be used, then you know, clearly we're already in a bad place. But there's so many more being rolled out. And, you know, whilst it's kind of, you know, whilst it's nice to see the Federal Trade Commission going after and you know, whacking vendors with a stick when they fail to update their IP cameras or whatever that we've talked about over the last 6 months, it would be much nicer to, of course, have these things required to be at least somewhat robust or patchable in advance rather than just, you know, smacking D-Link or Belkin or whoever after the fact.
Also, oh God, now I'm not sure if you had a chance to catch the presidential debates in the United States, but that was an interesting 90 minutes, let me tell you. I watched the whole thing, and Trump and Clinton both talking up the cybers, which, you know, really when you're dealing with the first presidential debate and they're actually speaking about this stuff, for those of us who've been around for quite a while in this discipline, it's bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, seeing this stuff be such a headline issue, I guess, in a place like the US, where normally it's about much more sort of prosaic things, you know, it is very different than what we've seen in the past. And of course, as you say, the whole thing is just such a disaster zone reality TV nightmare. That having, I mean, I guess the fact that it's about the cyber, you know, and I'm making scare quotes obviously around it with capital letters these days, I don't know. It's just a disaster. It's horrible. And yes, now we have the cyber as the word, the cybers, and the 400-pound hacker sitting on their bed.
Yes, and don't worry, because Trump has a son. He's 10 years old. He has computers. He's so good with these computers, it's unbelievable. The security aspect of cyber is very, very tough, and maybe it's hardly doable. But I will say, we are not doing the job we should be doing, but that's true throughout our whole governmental society. We have so many things to do better, Lester, and certainly cyber is one of them. Wise words indeed from Donald Trump. Now sticking with the cyber, and our good friend The Gruck wrote a fantastic piece on Medium that really walks through the thinking behind NSA's decision not to fess up about losing its firewall exploitation kit at the time that it happened. It turns out, you know, NSA knew for quite some time that its kit was likely exposed, but didn't take any action to allow a foreign intelligence service to know that they knew that it had been taken. And it's just a really great piece that he's written about that.
Yeah, certainly it should be required reading for anyone who is on the, you know, is having this argument about whether or not the intelligence agencies have some obligation to assist the private sector in patching their bugs or tell them about the bugs that they've got, or anything in that kind of avenue of state to private sector disclosure. Because it really does walk through, you know, fundamentally the fact is that the intelligence agencies, you know, the private sector really doesn't factor into their calculus. It is not an important aspect of their calculus to consider the impact on private sector, because really that's contrary to all of their other needs. And Gruck does a really good job of, you know, laying that out very clearly, so that people who don't necessarily understand, you know, the complex interplay between these things, you know, that you kind of have to understand the tech to get this knowledge organically. And he really lays it out very clearly for people who aren't, you know, day-to-day practitioners of this stuff.
And one of the things he does a good job of in that piece is sort of explaining why the NSA's decision isn't necessarily threatening the security of organizations that might be running the kit that's exploited by this particular exploit pack. Do you know what I mean? So it's sort of pours a bit of cold water on a lot of the hysteria around this. And I got to say, I agree with everything he's written, but it's just a really well-structured piece. Gruck's writing is coming along, hey. Like, he's becoming quite the opinion piece writer. switching our attention to Motherboard now, Joseph Cox has a story here. That ISIS-linked hacker, this guy, Ardit Farizi, who was arrested in Malaysia, we've spoken about this before, because he was charged with providing material support to a terrorist organization for compiling, you know, basically doxing a bunch of people who worked for the US military and giving that to a propagandist who worked for ISIS, who then made a big deal out of it. It got written up as an ISIS kill list and this sort of stuff. He's been sentenced and he got 20 years in the clink. I can't say I'm terribly, you know, upset about that, but at the same time, and this is an unpopular opinion, it makes me feel a little bit funny that doxing is now a terrorism offence.
Yeah, it is, right? It's you're kind of conflicted because, I mean, the fundamental act is the thing that he did was obtain some dumps from a hacked website, filter out the GovernMil email addresses, and then pass the data on to somebody else. Obviously, he was kind of a dick while he did it, you know, running, you know, pro-terrorist website forums and that kind of thing, which, I mean, you know, is a dick move. And there is a, you know, reasonable chance that people, you know, whose information he was passing on might get targeted. I mean, like, well, maybe reasonable is quite a strong word. There was a chance. But yeah, like whether that's a 20-year in jail kind of thing.
I know the interesting thing is he could have got a similar amount of time in prison without the terrorism charges. And that's why I find that whole material support thing just generally a little bit funny. I mean, you can be charged with material support for terrorism for providing translation services, for example, to a terrorist organization. You know, a lot of this stuff comes down to intent. I've spoken even with some DOD lawyers about cases like this, just, you know, over canapes sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? And it's an interesting thing because you say every time you try to come up with an example of where this could be a scary charge, they say, well, generally the courts filter out the misuse of these types of charges, but there's just something about this that still makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. Does this make you feel a bit funny in the pants also?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to encourage people to help out terrorist jerkbags. But on the other hand, there's plenty of dumb hacker kids on the internet that don't need to go to jail for 20 years for being a dumb punk kid. You know, you could just write angsty poetry and, you know, about how you feel about the world, and you would not go to jail for 20 years. And it's kind of, I don't, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I really don't know with that one. But yeah, as I say, it makes me feel uneasy. Speaking of legal stuff that makes me feel uneasy, here in Australia, the Attorney General's Department has proposed a law that's been sort of cut and pasted out of Britain, which would make it a criminal offence to write tools or de-anonymise anonymised data. Now, this comes hot on the heels of the government sort of announcing that it's going to release anonymised data sets involving things like welfare data, right? Because they're doing this big push, actually taking some policy from New Zealand, funnily enough, Adam, and looking at, you know, ways to optimise welfare delivery and stuff like that. They're going to be releasing some of this data anonymised to the public, and they're making it a criminal offence to de-anonymise it. Now, this seems like the backwards way of going. I would have thought it would make sense to put some more thought into how to anonymise data properly before you release it, instead of punishing people for pointing out mistakes in your approach.
Well, yeah, it does. It seems ass backwards. And of course, I mean, the thing they're trying to anticipate is de-anonymization techniques that they didn't think about, and sort of retroactive de-anonymization once the state of the art kind of advances. And, you know, I can see that just kind of making that go away by making it illegal is an attractive option rather than, as you say, having to think a bit more. But it just doesn't seem like a workable, you know, a workable way to go about it. And yeah, I mean, the challenges for de-anonymizing data sets, especially when, I mean, and use the New Zealand example where, you know, we are a very small country and anonymized data in New Zealand is quite difficult because of the very, very small number of people.
Because everybody knows everybody. It reminds me of when those Mossad guys were in, got caught in New Zealand trying to get, you know, fake Kiwi passports. And the reason they got caught is because the guy came in with his application form under an identity that it turned out, like, the guy who worked at the passport office, it was his friend. Like, the Mossad guy was trying to steal his friend's identity. I mean, this is only in New Zealand. Do you have something like this happen?
That is a very, very New Zealand thing to happen. Yes. Certainly makes social engineering in New Zealand a bit more difficult because, yeah, you end up impersonating someone's brother's cat's tennis partner and you get snapped. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, what do you? I mean, I also understand the appeal, but it just seems like a really it just seems like a really dumb law, to be honest.
Well, that's because it is dumb. I mean, yeah, it's just straight up dumb.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, I guess we got a coherent verdict on that one, at least as far as you and me go. Firefox. Let's go to some bread and butter tech now. Firefox is getting ready to dump a CA from its root trust because it did silly things.
Yeah, so I mean, we've often wondered what it would take to get a CA thrown out. We've seen a bit of stick waving with Symantec recently, you know, with their test certs being a little bit faster than those. And obviously then we had the actual breaches and stuff a couple of years back. But so this is a CA called WoSign who bought Startcom, the Israeli CA, a while ago. And they've been doing all sorts of dodgy looking stuff, backdating certificates to avoid the restrictions on SHA-1, like issuing...
Cute, man. Yeah, that right? How much effort do you have to go to just like, that's one of those things where you're trying to be lazy, but to actually maintain that level of laziness, you have to do more work than it would take to actually fix the thing. That's great. But go on, what were the other things?
They were like, essentially they had like a process where they would just issue whatever the hell you wanted and then go back and check later and revoke things, which then turned out to not be legit, which obviously isn't the approach you want from a root trusted CA, and a whole bunch of other stuff that was just, kind of rubbish quality validation of who they were issuing certs to and a real kind of cowboy attitude to it all. Interestingly enough, Mozilla also specifically call out the CA's auditors, Ernst & Young from Hong Kong, saying that Ernst & Young were doing a rubbish job of auditing them. And it kind of sounds like Mozilla wants to throw them out of the root trust store of their products. And of course, Google have said that they are looking into it as well. We'd hope Microsoft would follow suit and all of the other kind of root CA maintainers, the open source packaged root CA lists would also go down the same route. But obviously like this kind of CA banhammer is a thing that absolutely needs to be wielded so that people take it seriously.
Yeah, but I mean, have you taken a stroll through a root certificate store lately? Do you know what I mean? It's like, wow, I've never heard of those guys. It's just so many. And, my favorite go-to example, which is the Shanghai Post Office Digital Certificate Authority or whatever. Yeah, well, and you're like, how the hell did you get in there?
Obviously this is one of the key problems with the global CA trust store being trusted to sign anything and not having any other way of distinguishing who you trust to sign what. But, we have to deal with the mess that we are
in. Interestingly enough, I just remembered I saw a statistic the other day that, Let's Encrypt has become like the third biggest CA in the world or something, or the second biggest already, which is kind of interesting. There's hope.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, at least Let's Encrypt does expose the reality of the cert issuing process, which is that it's a very simple thing. It doesn't need to be expensive. And there is just no place in the world for, Komodo and...
I think I use a Komodo cert because I just wanted to be funny for risky.biz. Microsoft, meanwhile, has launched fuzzing as a service to help, people who are developing products for Windows, which is a really cool idea. I think this is just... really forward thinking and the type of service that, why didn't they offer it before? Why has no one offered this before? It's a great idea.
Yeah, it is, right? This is based on a tool that Microsoft have been using internally for a number of years. So obviously it's kind of relatively well tested and obviously finds good results for Microsoft internally. And yeah, exposing this to independent software vendors to use in Azure, I'm assuming, it's just a smart move. It's a great idea by Microsoft, and it improves the quality of Microsoft software ecosystem as a whole, and that's good for them as a platform. And it's just it's a good idea. If you are a software vendor, you should absolutely consider using it, because why wouldn't you? Like, what have you got to lose by giving it a whirl? Good on Microsoft.
Another one from Motherboard here, and apparently some attackers have stolen some internal documents from a Californian investment bank, and they're holding them to hostage, saying, we're going to dox you. I mean, there's nothing particularly novel about this, but it's rare to get the details on specific victims.
Yeah, I think this was the same crew that were trying to do it with, was it health records or something a while ago. So, I mean, clearly a fairly, shitty bunch of human beings, but... it's interesting seeing this kind of playing out in the public arena rather than behind the closed doors like you would imagine it is normally.
Yeah. Some controversy around the Linux kernel. And indeed, I think there's some sort of talk coming up at a conference about the wonders of linking web browsers to System D, which is making people just freak out and laugh at the same time. Have you seen this? Have you heard about this?
I'm just in denial about System D being an old school Unix nerd. I'm SysV in it for life, and System D doesn't even exist. I refuse to acknowledge it.
Well, anyway, a bunch of... look, I mean, there's some going talk that the Linux kernel needs a bit of a restumping, shall we say.
Yeah, and I mean, most of the articles in the newsreader, which is on ours, and it's quite a good write-up, is based on a presentation given by Keyes Cook, who is a long-time supporter of, kind of innovation and security in Linux. So he's done a lot of really good work on the Ubuntu project now, as onwards in Google doing that. And he's got some really good graphs and stats of like the lifetime of bugs inside the Linux kernel, kind of by severity over time, how long they lived. And that's some really interesting analysis for kind of justifying his argument that, these bugs really do live a lot longer than, say, the upstream kernel maintainers would like. And then also a breakdown of how many bugs in Android that are kernel are upstream kernel versus how many are device drivers. And that's obviously, a complete disaster. Like 85% of the bugs in Android that were kernel that are in kernel are not core kernel, like they're third party rubbish. So those are really interesting kind of data points to push the debate along about what exactly the upstream kernel maintainers can do to stop these bugs just living forever in IoT devices and in mobile devices and places where the kernel traditionally, like the main core kernel team, would go, oh, well, we fixed it upstream, not really our problem anymore, which is just not an option. And that's kind of the gist of the argument, I suppose.
It's interesting too. I mean, it's not actually I didn't put this in the show notes, but I heard earlier this week too, Windows is pushing out a bunch of updates where they're pushing a lot of system-based stuff into micro VMs. So you really got to worry when you're getting, well, I suppose, look, that's old thinking, but, Microsoft is kind of out innovating in the security area as compared to open source.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's an area where, the centralized leadership can decide that security is important and worth some inconvenience, whereas in the open source world, we don't get that kind of consensus so quickly. And Microsoft really is making good moves with, moving the credential processing into VMs, moving parts of the Edge browser into lightweight VMs to kind of isolate it in a way, could almost leapfrog past where Chrome is, which is absolutely a smart move.
They've been working with Bromium a lot on that. So I think next week in the sponsor interview, we'll be hearing all about that with Bromium CTO Simon Crosby. So there you go. There's a few more stories here. ThreatPost reports that Signal has added like a desktop app for iPhone users. Previously, it was only Android users who could use that. Ars Technica has a report about this site for teenage girls called iDressUp, which is apparently just hemorrhaging credentials because they've got SQLi all over their site and are refusing to fix it. Yeah. Someone reckons they've jailbroken the iPhone 7, someone with Form for doing jailbreak, so that's kind of interesting. And what else have we got here? ISC has patched a error condition in Bind, and Tesla has pushed out like code signing to subsystems in its cars, which is really cool. But at the same time, I was kind of thinking, why wasn't this the case already? I mean, if it was any other car company, I would have expected that they wouldn't have signed updates. But for them, it struck me as a bit weird.
Yeah, exactly. What were you doing shipping a car that's so dependent on technology that doesn't have code signing for firmware on your CAN bus devices? So apparently now it will very soon. But yeah, you shouldn't take a remote WebKit bug leading to control system compromise for you to turn on code signing or implement code signing on your car. Bad Tesla, no biscuit.
All right, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will chat again next week.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there of Insomnia Security with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it's time for this week's feature interview now, and the topic is satellite security. UK think tank Chatham House has released a report titled Space, the Final Frontier for Cybersecurity. And I was alerted to this report by the hysterical headlines I was confronted with over my morning coffee from the likes of news.com.au and Wired. Apparently, satellite insecurity is a looming catastrophe. Well, according to our next guest, not quite. Paul Marsh is the co-founder of SecQuest, a pen test firm in the United Kingdom, and he has a long history in security and technology. He's worked with AS400. He worked on IBM's ethical hacking team. And through that whole experience, that was before founding the consultancy, of course, and through that whole experience, he maintained a borderline obsessive interest in satellite technology. From his early years dabbling with intercepting unedited broadcast feeds from Gulf War One, I know a few people who got involved in satellite stuff by doing exactly that, his interest, Paul's interest, just grew and grew. And indeed, when I asked Twitter who I should talk to about the Chatham House report, Paul's name was the number one recommendation. Paul joined me via Skype to talk about the Chatham House report, and here's what he thought.
Yeah, so I think the report does hit on a few interesting points. I would say it is, of course, not written by people that are completely technically au fait with the methods of telemetry, command and control that are used in controlling satellites. They make a few points about the communication traffic that is sent via satellites and the fact that is open to attack on privacy and jamming and what have you. But I don't think there's anything groundbreaking in here. It is all pretty much well-known attack sort of vectors against stuff up in space. They do make a couple of good points about, you know, yes, the hardware is old, bearing in mind a lot of this stuff has to go through space qualification processes, and so it's not going to have the latest and greatest security mechanisms that we have on the ground. You know, you're probably looking at generation around Z80 or immediately after, when you take into account, you know, radiation hardening and real-time hardened operating systems, etc. But I would say some of the things that they've got in here relating to the ease of controlling a satellite or taking it over, I don't for any moment think that is something which is trivial.
So it's not a case that it's very, very easy for, you know, someone who's good with embedded device hacking and software-defined radio to all of a sudden get, you know, a Chinese satellite to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere or something.
No. I mean, most, if you look at geostationary satellites, so this is these are the ones that have fairly large footprints covering, you know, for example, Europe or North America, what have you. Most of these are fairly autonomous. Obviously, there's a lot of monitoring that goes on to determine, you know, its attitude and the sun pointing and how much battery charge level and what have you that there is. And if the spacecraft thinks for any reason there is a something has gone into a fault mode, it will have a recovery process. And the majority of these, and, you know, you read press reports of satellite or apparent satellite hacks in the past, where something has happened and there's been a loss of service. Now, this is most likely to be auto fault detection and correction on the satellite. And the first thing it will do is a sun acquisition maneuver. So it will rotate and point its solar panels so they get as much power as possible from the sun. Obviously, you don't want to get into a situation where you've got a lump of hardware where the battery's gone flat and, you know, at that point it is dead and you can't do anything with it. So even if you were to jam the TT&C uplink to a satellite, you know, it's not going to do anything immediately. Obviously, the legitimate ground operator will know that the closed loop of command and monitoring has been disrupted, and then they can take steps to do something about that, and that would most likely be crank up the power to try and override whatever's jamming the uplink. But, you know, the uplink isn't, for example, 1200 baud ASCII commands. You know, that it is convoluted. Obviously, it's encrypted. There's an extremely long key. Even if you do a replay attack, again, the satellite's not going to respond to that.
So some thought did actually go into this stuff. It's not like they're flying, you know, home thermostats, you know, with those, you know, same sort of awful embedded systems. There are some controls here, and they did, you know, use what, like symmetric keys or whatever, and they really thought about it.
Yeah, it's, I would say, a complete world away from the internet of rubbish that you see advertised everywhere, you know, cheap $5 things that attach to internet to do a particular job. You know, you're talking about resilient, hardened computers, radiation hardened, real-time operating systems, you know, N number of fault monitoring and self-diagnosis type functions. So I don't think that you can compare what is flying on a satellite platform with an IoT device. The only possibility of something close might be a university CubeSat that has had a very fast development time, and they're using bog standard off the shelf, you know, an Android phone with a bit of tinfoil wrapped around it for radiation hardening.
Yeah, and a couple of solar panels sort of glued onto it. Yeah. One thing that occurred to me, though, is looking at this issue, and of course, I can understand why organizations like Chatham House are publishing things like this. And it's mostly because, you know, satellites are a big deal, and space security from a geopolitical military point of view is also kind of a big deal. We remember a few years ago when the Chinese fired a missile up to take out one of their own satellites. That was a demonstration of capability, just to say, hey, guess what? You know, we can take down satellites. And I'm guessing it costs a fair bit of money to send a missile into space and to knock out a satellite. So there are other options. You know, you can hit them with lasers and try to burn out some sensors. That, of course, makes a lot of sense. You know, jamming, as we've already discussed. One thing, though, that probably strikes me as the most plausible type of attack vector is not necessarily, you know, intercepting the signals or taking over the command and control channel, via RF. It would be more attacking the ground infrastructure, because I'm guessing the network separation with a lot of the organizations that control these satellites isn't necessarily fantastic.
Sure. I mean, I suppose that there are parallels between, for example, SCADA environments that historically were, you know, low-speed serial out to RTUs everywhere, and what you might find at a typical ground control station for a satellite. But, you know, bearing in mind, when a satellite is commanded, you don't, you know, just press a button that says fire thruster and make it move in the Z-axis or make it roll. You know, anything that is sent up to a satellite usually, well, I would say in 99% of cases, runs through a ground simulator, first of all. So this is a computer which runs the same software that is running on the satellite. They package up a command sequence, send it to the ground simulator, you know, verify two or three times that it does what the what the command sequence said it should do, and then only when they're happy will they commit it and send it in the telemetry to the satellite. As for getting anywhere near that sort of stuff, most of the ground stations that I've seen and looked at the sort of telemetry generation and what have you are separate computers. There's no physical bits of wire between the internal, corporate network and the subsystems, which are responsible for directly controlling the satellite. So I would say remotely, it's probably hard to do, if not impossible. It would probably be easier to get a job there and to misuse the platform and send wrong commands after having confirmed it on a simulator. But I don't think that remotely you could do anything which would jeopardize a spacecraft. You know, there have been some press reports, for example, about 10 years ago, there was something rumbling around to say a British Skynet military satellite had an incident, but you know, when you look at what actually happened, basically the antennas off pointed from Earth. It was most likely a glitch on board, and it went into an emergency sun acquisition
some sort
mode.
Some sort of recovery mode, yeah. Now, as you said, right, these things are equipped with decent encryption, and some thought's been put into the way that they are, the way that they're managed. And that's, you know, quite reassuring considering they're all above us right now. But say there was a problem discovered in, say, an authentication or encryption, you know, process or algorithm or however you want to describe it, I imagine it would be borderline impossible to actually patch these things. Is that the case?
I would say probably the majority of geostationary satellites have embedded software that possibly cannot be changed. Again, the reason for this, you know, they're real-time hardened OSs. There is an awful lot of self-diagnosis and fault determination stuff built in. Most of it, I think, relies on security by obscurity in that the uplink telemetry is, I won't say bespoke, but, you know, it's virtually impossible to find any details of spec. So in order to start the process, you know, you would have to go to a ground station, capture days or weeks worth of uplink telemetry to try and reverse it. And then, of course, if you have a stream cipher over the top of that, it's going to make your life more difficult.
So but probably easier to shoot it down and point a laser at it, I think is what you're getting at.
I would have thought so. Mm. One of the areas that they do talk about in the report, which I think is valid, is the unintentional or pirate use of satellites. I don't think that is anything that you can ever stop. If you look at, you know, any of the US military satellites, I was only checking one out a couple of hours ago, and it is literally full of Brazilian pirate operators talking through it. They treat these like a CB. And, it, you know, it,
so how does that work? Are these satellites sort of designed to, by default, forward certain bands? Is that how people who aren't supposed to be using them can use them?
Yes. If you equate a satellite transponder to a router with no ACLs, that is effectively what happens. You send something to it. Most satellites have what we call a bent pipe transponder. And, you know, you point an antenna at the satellite, send a signal at the correct frequency, and it will enter one end of the pipe, be turned round, amplified, and come out of the other end, which is pointing back at Earth. And in the case of the US MILSATs, they have low frequency UHF up and down links around 250 to 300. And what's happening in Brazil is the guys there are using 2 meter ham radio transmitters, which operate at about 145 megahertz. The output of that is fed to a very simple varactor doubler, which increases that to about 290 megahertz. And of course, that falls right in the uplink passband of, say, for example, Fleet Satcom, and they use it like a CB. And, you know, any time of day or night.
But why? When you say pirates, I'm assuming you don't mean like pirates, right?
Well, some of them could be, but most of them are truck drivers or people that simply want to chat to their friends who might live at the other end of South America.
This is why Brazilian judges should stop blocking WhatsApp, because it floods the US fleet satellites with Brazilian Portuguese. A lovely language, though, I must say. But that is quite bizarre that they didn't put any sort of protection on that. But I guess it's hard then, because then you've got a key distribution problem, don't you? And this is the sort of stuff that should just work.
Yeah, this is true. So bearing in mind, you know, when the original LeeSat and Fleet Satcom satellites were launched, we're talking a number of years ago, sort of 70s and 80s, and the technology to do, proper demand assigned multiple access with strong authentication was simply not there. So as with every TV satellite, they have a receiver on board. The output of the receiver is connected to an amplifier and a transmitter. So whatever you point up at the satellite is reflected back down to Earth. There's, you know, there's no bolt-on or software patch or any type of mod that you can do to the existing hardware to prevent this. The only real way to prevent, I guess, unauthorized use of a transponder is to turn it off.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's a curly one, but I just love that it's Brazilian truck drivers who are using this. That's just amazing. And believe me, Brazilian truck drivers were the bane of my existence during a recent road trip. They you know, I don't find it hard to believe that they're troublemakers.
No, I mean, most of them, it's quite interesting. they have, I guess, clear use of the language to the point where if you use the Google Translate application in listen mode, it can translate in near real time what they're chatting about. And
look out, the cops in Minas are giving tickets to people, just a heads up.
It is generally inane chit-chat that you might have found on the CB in the 80s. I would say most of the UHF pirates, you know, there were a few from around Moscow that were using another US MILSAT, Inmarsat, which is the satellite constellation originally designed for maritime users. That has had its share of pirates in the past, and I don't mean the pirate
type, yes,
but the type that like to play with satellites. The uplink equipment is a little bit more complicated, but still it does happen.
People have fooled around with stuff like Iridium, though. They have found issues with those satellite ecosystems, right? So it's not out. I mean, there is a reason why people assume that there can be sort of standard pop shell or, you know, authentication issues with various types of satellites.
Yeah, I think if you take the case of Iridium, so some excellent work done by Second Schneider on this resulted in the GR Iridium toolkit, and you know, that allows you to basically eavesdrop on various downlinks from Iridium. Now, there has been some attacks against the actual devices which are used on the ground, so this is the modems, the handsets, what have you. Again, these have, I guess, rudimentary CPUs in them. You know, a lot of the Inmarsat Mini-M sort of notebook-type terminals, we've looked at these, and you know, you take the EEPROM out and you dump that and you pick through the firmware and find plain text sort of passwords for maintenance mode and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, there are attack vectors on the actual
handsets, but yeah, not so much on the satellite itself.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Now, when we see these headlines that have been doing the rounds following the release of this report, I mean, I'm looking at one right in front of me from Wired that says hackers targeting satellites could cause catastrophic damage. Catastrophic, of course, in air quotes. I mean, what do you make of these headlines? Do you think that it's the report authors who've misunderstood this, or do you think it's the journalists who've been responsible for the subsequent coverage?
I don't know. I guess it is obviously a bit of misunderstanding about what can and cannot be done. You could say, for example, if you were to go and take out an Intelsat ground station somewhere, Ficino in Italy, that you could cause a catastrophic damage to comms that are going via that teleport. Well, that's obvious. You know, you're taking out a ground station that has massive amounts of incoming bandwidth from satellite and then dropping that onto fiber for, you know, use on the ground. But I think a lot of it is sensationalist headlines. When you look at actually into the technicalities of what is needed to cause damage, you know, as the Chatham House report says, jamming. So, you know, anybody can find a big dish and a big traveling wave tube amplifier and a signal generator and squirt some signals up to destroy what is being sent through the satellite. But I wouldn't say it would be catastrophic. Some satellites do have nulling technologies and they can effectively null a ground interferer. Most TV satellites don't have this. But then, you know, if a few TV channels get knocked out, who cares really?
Now, that's not to say people in private industry should just take the satellite operator's word for it when they say that everything is honky-dory. You've told me before we were recording that that you should really seek those assurances from your provider.
Yeah, this is true. I would say, and this is most certainly based on experience, you know, we've tested a number of VSAT links, so these are point-to-point hops via satellite. Vendors have said, oh yes, it's encrypted, you know, there's a end-to-end triple DES or whatever they happen to use. Here is the user manual on the satellite modem and it says, you know, encryption is here. And when you actually drill down to the small print, the majority of cases have been, well, yes, encryption is an optional extra or a licensable feature and you haven't bought it. And, you know, we've tested, for example, banks down in Eastern Europe and found, you know, they're bridging data from a remote office to their head office over what they thought was a secure link. And when you actually look at it, it's going over the wire, or over the air in the clear. You can intercept it and see transaction details from ATMs, internal systems, emails, you name it. I mean, it's literally like being sat on a corporate network back in the good old days of 10Base 2, where you could sniff everything with Wireshark.
Great. So, I mean, does that mean you should add your own encryption layer, or you really should just get the satellite provider to do that for you? Because I'm guessing that it's pretty expensive bandwidth and you don't really want to be adding any extra headers or anything like that, right?
Yeah, that's true. I would say if, you know, most VSAT suppliers, they, you know, they understand what the modem is doing and they will present it as, here is an Ethernet socket, and if you plug a computer in here in the Middle East, it will come out at the other end of the link, which is in London. And if you ask them any technical details about, you know, the encapsulation, how it is transmitted over the satellite link, you will not get concise answers. So I would always say if you cannot be 100% sure that the transmission medium is secure, then either end of it, you must add your own encryption.
All right, Paul Marsh, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about this Chatham House report, and indeed to hose it down a bit and let us know that this isn't something we need to spend the next 12 months digging into, because it sounds like it's remarkably mostly under control. Paul Marsh, again, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Paul Marsh there with a chat about satellite security. It's not often we have a reassuring interview on this show, so that's nice. That's real nice. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Chris Thomas, aka Space Rogue. Chris, of course, works for this week's sponsor, Tenable Network Security. This is a company that has supported Risky Business for the better part of a decade. And it's been a real pleasure for me watching it grow from a tiny little niche company, really, when it started, into what it is now, which is a provider of established, proven, respected technology. Nessus is a product, of course, that is very well respected, with good reason. But Tenable also makes other stuff. They've got their passive vulnerability detection gear, which is really, really quite cool. They also make a log correlation engine that isn't really a seam. They're not really in the seam space per se. They've taken things in their own direction. But look, long story short, Tenable is a company whose products you should at least be familiar with. So please do check them out at tenable.com. And if you do choose their tech, tell them Risky Business sent you. Anyway, this week's sponsor interview with Chris looks at e-voting. Two bills have been proposed in the United States that aim to improve the security of the e-voting ecosystem. And given recent events like the DNC hack, it's not out of the question that a foreign power might seek to interfere with the US election via, you know, online attacks, basically, if only to discredit the democratic process rather than influence the result. Now, of course, these bills have precisely zero chance of being passed before the election, let alone being around long enough to make an impact in time for this one. But Chris and I thought it would make sense to have a bit of a chat about how e-voting in the USA is actually regulated. As you'll hear, there basically isn't any sort of central control over this stuff. Here's Chris.
Well, electronic voting in the United States becomes a very hot topic every 4 years.
Yeah.
An interesting topic every 2 years. And of course, right now we're on the 4-year cycle. And so it's become a rather hot button topic, especially with at least one of the candidates calling into question the veracity of electronic voting, especially if he should lose. As a result of all of this press and attention that electronic voting has gotten in the last couple of weeks, we now have two new bills in Congress, both introduced by Representative Hank Johnson, a Democrat out of Georgia, to try to make things a little bit more secure. Unfortunately, neither one of these bills will take effect until after the election.
Well, one thing that I found interesting is we had a bit of a chat before I hit record, and you described to me and I'm going to use air quotes here. I know this is an audio show, but I'm going to use air quotes, the oversight over e-voting systems. And I was a little bit shocked to discover that basically there isn't any. There's no like federal standard. There's no security standard applied to this stuff, even for federal elections. Is that right?
Right. So all elections in the United States are handled at the local level, usually the county level. You have a county board of volunteers. They aren't even elected officials to oversee the election. And then each small community, not even at the town or city level, the community level, oversees the local jurisdiction of that election. So that's why you go to your local school, your grade school, if you will, your polling place, sometimes at the fire department, and your neighbors man the booths and check the registration rolls and see if you're allowed to vote. It's handled at the local level. Now, all that's handled, even for federal elections for president and senators and House of Representatives, is all handled locally. There are a couple of federal laws on the books that do apply, the Help America Vote Act of 2002, which basically has there's two federal agencies. There's NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, and the EAS, the Election Assistance Commission, or maybe it's EAC. Anyway, those two groups are responsible for giving assistance to local boards. But that assistance is voluntary, and the local boards need to ask for it. So this particularly comes into play with certifying election equipment in voting computers. Most local boards, which are run by local people who, you know, don their election official hat once a year, every November, don't really have the background to certify voting computers.
Well, this is where it gets interesting, right? Because here in Australia, like, yeah, it's the same thing. When I go to vote, right, it's probably, you know, Sally from the sandwich shop who might mark my name off the electoral roll or whatever. But, you know, all of the ballot papers are printed by the Australian Electoral Commission. Do you know what I mean? Like, we don't actually have e-voting here, but it's all of the little cardboard pop-up booths. They all say AEC on them. There's all of the processes are mandated by the federal government, and, you know, kind of seems to work pretty well. But this idea that, you know, you're going to get it down in the weeds to that point, I'm guessing, you know, some county might decide to do e-voting because their cousin Jim Bob over there, you know, he's good with computers, right? So we're going to let Jim Bob come up with a thing. And that's how you wind up with hanging chads.
Exactly. So we've had this, we had an issue with vote 8 years ago, hanging chads with Al Gore and George Bush, I guess it was 16 years ago in Florida. And it made it to the Supreme Court. It was a big, big constitutional crisis in the United States. And so we thought we solved the problem after that, and we passed some laws. That was the Help America Vote Act 2002. And now here we are 16 years later, and we're casting doubt onto our process.
This is the first I've ever heard of this non-approach to e-voting security, and I'm starting to, for the first time, you know, and this stuff comes up. Honestly, I don't find it terribly, terribly interesting, you know. I mean, it's not, obviously it's very important, but it's not a topic that I dive into much because it just seems clear that, well, you go for a paper trail, you use audited devices, pretty easy to mandate from a top-down level. And then you tell me that nothing is mandated from a top-down level, and all of a sudden I'm just sort of face-palming over here, right?
Yeah, in the U.S., it varies from state to state, but in most states, it's down at the county level and sometimes even lower. And so you mentioned paper trail. So you have a lot of machines with, and I'm going to call them voting computers as opposed to voting machines, because when you add a touchscreen and a USB port and whatnot, it's a computer, right?
Mm.
So, and they're subject to the same crashes and hacks and other issues that standard computers have too. But anyway, so you mentioned paper trail. Some voting computers have voter-verified paper audit forms, which is basically a receipt that prints out that the voter can look at and said, yeah, that's how I vote, how I voted. And that way, if there's a recount or something afterwards, you can refer to that paper receipt to verify the vote.
But see, I thought the whole point of e-voting was just to speed up the count, but you'd still do a manual count anyway based on the output, like the physical output of these computers, right?
So there are some, and they're called direct record electronic voting machines, and I'm going to use the word computer again, that don't have a paper trail. And there are a limited number of jurisdictions in the United States that use these systems that don't have the paper trail. And those systems are, of course, are the ones that everybody's concerned about. Is there enough there to sway a national election, enough voting machines that somebody could mess around with to actually cause a change in the national election for president or maybe even for a senator? I don't know. Maybe. It's a small percentage. I think it's about 16% of the total electorate that uses these types of machines. I think they're in three different states. But that is a possibility.
But I think what we've learned in recent times too is, you know, if we're talking about a foreign power, a foreign intelligence service, their objective might not necessarily be to influence an election, rather than to discredit an election. Now, if you could, say, hack into a few counties' voting machines and make the results look funny, or at least invalidate some results from some booths, that would be national news. And it would, to an extent, in the minds of many people, particularly the people on the losing side of an election, when the candidate that they didn't support won, they would cry foul. They would say the process is rigged. Clearly there should be another election, on and on and on. Now, I'm sure that this is a conversation that is occurring in the intelligence community and the defense, you know, within the defense establishment and whatnot within the United States. But I guess that leads to my question. Well, how seriously is that being taken? And is this proposed bill, or these proposed bills, are they likely to actually get anywhere?
Well, they definitely won't get anywhere before this election. And even if they did, they're not going to take effect until next year. So these bills, while they may be good or bad, depending on where you stand on them, they're not going to impact this election. But you do bring up a good point about people wondering about the veracity of the election, and that issue may be already on the table. Like, it's not, we may not need to compromise any voting computers because of the breach that we know about at the DNC, and presumably also the RNC, because I can't imagine somebody would just break into one party.
Well, but they didn't dox the GOP.
They didn't dox the RNC.
So that's the thing. I mean, political intelligence collection is one thing. You know, the doxing is a whole separate thing. But look, when Goldman Sachs goes to the polls against the fascist kumquat man-child this November...
I have not heard that analogy used before. That's a good analogy.
Yeah, it's Goldman Sachs versus Hitler Lite, right? That's this year's election. So when they go... I mean, you guys are already using computers to do voting without paper records. Is that actually the case in the United States?
Yeah, there are some jurisdictions that have direct recording equipment that are being used. I think there are three states that have some jurisdictions that are using electronic voting computers without VPATs, verified voter audit trails.
And it's not like we haven't seen bugs reported in these machines before. I remember even years ago we saw Diebold. You know, I mean, they make ATMs and all that sort of stuff. They make voting computers as well, and we've seen some pretty awful bugs in voting computers, where people can even just by manipulating the screen control start racking up false votes and things like that. Now, you might catch that in an audit trail, but that said, it's going to add a level of uncertainty to counts from that booth.
Exactly. A lot of these vulnerabilities, a lot of people say, oh, those are old, those have been fixed, those machines aren't being used anymore. But there was actually a report issued by the Institute for Critical Infrastructure Technology in September of this year. Hacking elections is easy, where they go through several machines and find vulnerabilities that are existing in current machines being used today. But it's the voting computers themselves are not really the issue, because those are seldom connected to the internet at all anyway. It's these systems called EMS, Electronic Management System, Electronic Voting Management System. That's the machine that's used to write the config file for the voting computer. So every year you have a new ballot, you have new people running, you have new things you're voting on, you have to have a new configuration file for every voting computer, and that voting computer, that file then gets uploaded to the computer. Well, that file is created on a different computer that is often connected to the internet. It is also the computer that is also often used to tabulate the votes. And so one of the provisions in one of these new bills is that voting computers cannot be connected to the internet. Well, that's great. But it doesn't say anything about the
election. No, because it's an ecosystem, isn't it, right? It's not just about the endpoint devices. It's about, you know, the whole chain of custody for that information. Do these bills, I mean, how far do they go in terms of, mandating actual sensible things? Like, you know, there should be some security testing on these voting computers. There should be a paper trail. Does it say anything about that stuff, or is it just fiddling around the edges in that?
First bill, the Election Integrity Act of 2016, does mandate VVPATs or voter verified paper audit trail. But that's it.
But I mean, that's got to be the most important control, right?
No,
because
it's not.
No.
I mean, the only other thing that's mandated is, and that everybody's talking about, is that the infrastructure voting systems would become critical infrastructure in the United States and join the 16 other categories of critical infrastructure that we have, like banking, electrical grid, water systems, chemical plants, which are all considered critical infrastructure. And so voting would then become no longer a local issue run by your county election board. It would then come under an umbrella of Department of Homeland Security. So we would then probably have a TSA-style agency running elections in the United States, which, in my opinion, would probably not be one of the best things.
Well, I don't like the idea of voting without my shoes or belt either. And, you know, of course, this further, I mean... Because just, you know, understanding a little bit about the mentality of Americans, the idea of a big, bad federal government agency controlling the way people vote, I mean, tyranny, right? Like, and also, you know, if you did have a paranoid candidate who was somewhat detached from reality, I'm not saying this would ever happen, but if you did, they might start crying foul and saying that the Department of Homeland Security was trying to throw the election, right?
Yeah, that's a very distinct possibility. But then again, for every American we have who would yell tyranny for that sort of action, there's another American who would welcome such actions to happen. Mm. I know it sounds kind of crazy, but we do have people like that here in this country. But yeah, that would also run the risk of people crying foul and saying, hey, you know, the DHS or whoever has it out for me, they don't like me. They didn't want me to be elected. And so they tampered with the election. And so without some,
it sounds like Alex Jones's wet dream, right? But look, brass tacks. Do you think these bills would be a positive thing if they were passed into law? Do you think they would actually move the needle in the right direction?
No, I don't think they would move it in the wrong direction, but I don't think they're really going very far in the right direction. I think it's very timely to have these bills in the press and on the floor right now. It's very late in the legislative session this year, so they're probably not going to advance very far. They may see action next session if they're kept alive that long. But I think by then, the interest in voting technologies and legislation for voting issues is going to wane, and I don't expect very much action on these bills whatsoever.
And let's see, when there is some action, you know, by the time it passes, the bill might substantially be designed at the point that it actually gets signed into law to build a hydroelectric plant in Wyoming, because that's how system seems to work.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of amendments. So yeah, in 4 years from now, when we have our next election, or maybe 8 years from now, this issue will come up again, and it will be a hot button topic on everybody's media outlets, including yours probably. And I'll probably be on here again in 4 years talking about the same exact thing. And instead of that, we'll just rerun this same interview.
Yes, there you go. It is one of those topics. That's kind of why I tuned out of it, you know, some years ago. But, you know, you're assuming you will have elections in 4 to 8 years. And I think, that's a bit of an open question at the moment. Chris Thomas, it has been a pleasure to chat to you about this stuff. We really appreciate your time, and we will chat to you again soon.
Thank you for having me.
That was Chris Thomas, aka Space Rogue, there with a chat about electronic voting security. Big thanks to Tenable Network Security for its sponsorship of this week's show. And that's actually it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.